In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Spending Thanksgiving at my cousin Matt's farm had always been something of a family tradition. It was an expansive, stunning property, complete with a big barn, a mirror-like pond, and a tree line that seemed infinite. For a city guy like me, spending a few days in the countryside was always refreshing. This year was no different. The house buzzed with laughter, clinking plates, and the pitter-patter of kids racing across the hardwood floor. Matt's 5-year-old son, Ben, was the life of the gathering, darting around with a plastic dinosaur in hand and a smile that could light up the whole room. The adults were gathered around the dining table, savoring turkey, mashed potatoes, and all the usual Thanksgiving staples. Outside, the kids were playing tag, their shrieks of laughter echoing through the crisp November air. Everything felt perfect, until it didn't. It started with a simple question: where's Ben? Matt's wife, Lillian, was the first to notice. She'd gone outside to call the kids in for pie and realized Ben wasn't with the group. At first, no one panicked. Kids wander. It's what they do. "He's probably in the barn," Matt said, getting up from the table. "He loves it in there." A few of us decided to help look. We split up, calling out Ben's name as we checked the barn, the house, and the surrounding yard. "Ben, where are you, buddy?" The barn was empty, save for the horses calmly chewing hay. The house was quiet, with no sign of tiny sneakers hiding under the furniture. That's when the unease started to creep in. "Did anyone see him go toward the woods?" I asked, looking at the tree line. Matt's face tensed. He knows not to go past the fence. "Kids don't always listen," I managed to speak, keeping my tone as calm as possible. "Let's check anyway." The group spread out along the edge of the property, calling Ben's name louder now. My firefighter training kicked in. I scanned the ground for footprints, checked bushes for signs of movement, and tried to think like a 5-year-old. Where would I go if I were Ben? About 15 minutes into the search, Lillian's voice rang out, sharp and panicked. "I see him." We all turned toward her. She was standing near the far end of the property, pointing toward the trees. I felt relieved until I saw what she was pointing at. Ben was there, standing near the tree line, but he wasn't alone. A man stood beside him, tall and dressed in dark, worn clothes. His hand rested on Ben's shoulder as if they were old friends. "Ben!" Matt yelled, breaking into a sprint. The man jerked his head up, startled. Without hesitation, he released Ben and bolted into the woods. I didn't think, I just ran after him. The underbrush was thick, and the man was fast. I caught glimpses of his figure weaving through the trees, but he always stayed just out of reach. My heart hammered as I pushed forward. Then he was gone. The forest was silent except for my heavy breathing and the distant calls of my family. I scanned the area, but there was no sign of him. Frustrated and shaken, I made my way back to the edge of the woods. When I returned, Lillian was holding Ben tightly, tears streaming down her face. Matt was on the phone with the police, his voice tight with anger. "What happened?" I asked, kneeling down to Ben's level. He looked up at me, wide-eyed and innocent. "The man said he had a surprise for me. He wanted to show me something in the woods." An eerie coldness passed through me. "Did he hurt you?" I asked gently. Ben shook his head. "No, he was nice. But when you all started yelling, he got scared." The police arrived about half an hour later. They combed the woods with flashlights and dogs, but they didn't find anything. No tracks, no clues, nothing. The officer who took our statements seemed genuinely concerned. "Do you know him?" he asked Matt. "No," Matt replied. "I've never seen him before." "He didn't seem like a local," Lillian added, "but who knows? He could have been watching us for days." The police said it might have been a drifter or someone passing through, but that explanation didn't sit well with me. Whoever that man was, he knew exactly where Ben would be. He didn't stumble onto the property by accident. He'd planned this. The next morning, Matt and I were stuck with this sense of deep anger, so we decided to search the property ourselves. We combed every inch of the woods, starting near the tree line where we'd found Ben and going deeper. That's when we noticed something odd. Truck tire tracks pressed into the dirt near a secluded clearing. They weren't fresh, but they were distinct enough to stand out against the otherwise undisturbed ground. "What's that?" I asked, pointing toward the tracks. Matt knelt down, running his hand along the grooves. "Looks like someone's been parking here," he said, "for a while." The tire marks overlapped in several places, like the truck had been parked in the same spot multiple times. Nearby, we found an empty soda can and a cigarette butt, both seemingly left behind recently. "This guy wasn't just passing through," Matt said. "He's been watching us." This man had been on the property for days, maybe even longer, waiting for the right moment. I couldn't help but think about all the times Ben had played outside, running freely through the fields, completely unaware someone was lurking so close. We collected what little evidence we could and called the police again. They returned to inspect the site, taking photos of the tire tracks and the discarded items. One of the officers looked especially concerned as he examined the scene. "He's been camping out here," the officer said. "This wasn't random. He was watching your family." That confirmation only deepened the pit in my stomach. The officers promised to increase patrols in the area and assured us they'd be on the lookout for any suspicious activity. But their reassurances couldn't erase the fear that lingered in all of us. Thanksgiving will never feel the same to me. What started as a day of gratitude turned into one of the scariest experiences of my life. Every time I see Ben running around with that carefree smile, I think about how close we came to losing him. The image of that man at the tree line holding Ben's shoulder will haunt me forever. And the knowledge that he'd been sitting in the woods, waiting for his moment, chills me to this day. Thanksgiving had always been my favorite holiday. It wasn't just the food, it was the tradition of everyone gathering around the table, laughing over old stories and creating new ones. This year I was hosting at my home. It was the first time in years I had both sides of the family under one roof, and I wanted everything to be perfect. The smell of turkey roasting in the oven filled the house, mixing with the faint cinnamon scent of pumpkin pie cooling on the counter. My husband Dave was busy slicing vegetables, and our two kids were playing board games in the living room. The vibe was perfect, exactly how Thanksgiving should feel. Just as we sat down for dinner, a loud, abrupt knock echoed through the room, silencing the laughter and conversation at the table. We all exchanged puzzled looks. No one was expecting anyone else. "I'll get it," I said, pushing back my chair. Opening the door, I found myself face to face with a man I didn't recognize. He was in his late 40s, with a worn jacket. His hands were stuffed into his pockets, and he looked tired, or maybe uneasy. "Sorry to bother you," he began, his voice flat. "My car broke down up the road. Could I use your phone to call for help?" The way he spoke didn't feel right to me. It wasn't the words themselves, but the way he said them. Too rehearsed, like he'd told the same story before. "I'm sorry," I replied, keeping my voice polite but firm. "We don't let strangers in. There's a gas station about a mile back that might be able to help you." He stared at me for a moment. "I don't need to come in. Just let me use your phone." I shook my head, apologizing again before shutting the door. Locking it, I leaned against it for a moment, letting out a breath. Dave came up behind me, raising an eyebrow. "Who was that?" "Some guy," I said. "Said his car broke down. I told him to try the gas station." We returned to the table, and I did my best to forget about the odd encounter. The evening went on, and soon we were gathered in the living room, sipping coffee and digging into slices of pie. The kids had moved to the family room to watch a movie, and the adults were reminiscing about old holidays. Then, I saw movement near the back window. At first, I assumed it was nothing more than my reflection, or an odd shadow. But when I turned to look directly, I froze. There he was, the same man from earlier, standing in the dark, staring inside. My breath hitched as I tried not to panic. "Dave," I whispered, nudging his arm. "What?" I gestured toward the window, and his expression shifted immediately. He stood, careful not to make any sudden moves, and walked over to pull the curtain closed. "What the hell is he doing here?" Dave asked. "I don't know," I whispered back. "We need to call the police." Dave grabbed his phone and stepped into the corner of the room, speaking quietly to the dispatcher. I tried to act normal, but my nerves must have shown because my sister-in-law, Marie, furrowed her brow. "What's going on?" she asked. "Nothing. Just someone's outside," I admitted. That caught everyone's attention. My brother Greg stood up, his expression serious. "Someone's outside? Who?" "It's the guy from earlier," I said, motioning toward the window. "He's been standing there watching us." Greg looked toward the window. "What the hell? I'll go scare him off." "No," I hissed, grabbing his arm. "We don't know if he's armed." A thick silence followed my words. Greg looked at Dave, who was still on the phone. "Do we even have anything to defend ourselves with?" he asked. Dave shook his head. "It's Thanksgiving, Greg. Nobody thought to bring a weapon." Marie's face paled. "So, what do we do? Just sit here?" "Yes," I said firmly. "The dispatcher told Dave to stay inside and keep the doors locked. The police are on their way." Greg's shoulders tensed, and for a moment, I thought he might ignore me and head out anyway. But then we all heard the sound of footsteps moving along the side of the house. Everyone froze. "Is he trying to get in?" Marie whispered. "Probably checking the doors," Dave said quietly, his voice strained. "Stay calm. They said the officers would be here in less than 10 minutes. The weight of the tension in the room felt crushing. Every sound outside seemed to tighten the grip on my chest. When the sound of rattling doorknobs reached the living room, I felt Marie's hand tighten around mine. "He's trying the back door," Greg said, his voice filled with tension. He moved toward the kitchen window to peek outside, but quickly ducked back when he saw the man moving toward the front porch. "Okay, let's stay together," I said, trying to keep everyone focused. "He's trying to scare us. Just stay inside." Another knock came, heavier this time, like he was pounding the door with the butt of a handgun. The kids, who had been playing upstairs, started to come down, clearly sensing something was wrong. "What's happening?" my niece asked. Marie stepped in quickly. "Stay upstairs, sweetie. We're just handling something grown up right now, okay?" The pounding grew louder, and a shiver crept down my back as the man's shadow stretched across the frosted glass of the door. Dave motioned for everyone to move into the dining room, further from the entry points. "Police are almost here," he said quietly, his voice firm. "Stay calm." The next few minutes stretched on endlessly. The man outside continued pacing around the house, occasionally knocking or testing a door. The quiet made every little noise feel deafening as we waited, praying the police would arrive before he decided to do more than knock. It felt like hours before we saw the flashing red and blue lights outside. The footsteps retreated into the darkness just as the police arrived. Dave unlocked the door, and two officers approached cautiously. They found the man near the edge of our property, crouched by the fence as if waiting for another opportunity. One officer stayed with us while the other escorted him to the squad car. Inside, the officer who stayed back asked us a series of questions. Did we know him? Had he threatened us directly? "No," I said, shaking my head.
Lowe's knows you want the best for dad. This Father's Day, help him take on any project with big deals on DeWalt. Right now, get a free XR 8 amp hour battery when you buy select DeWalt tools. That's not all. Get up to two free select tools when you buy a select DeWalt 20 volt max battery kit. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a work load is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Head. But he was watching us through the window, and he tried the doors. The officer nodded, jotting notes on his pad. "We'll file a report and issue a trespassing warning. If he comes back, call us immediately." That night, I barely slept. Every sound from the house made me sit bolt upright. The next morning, we found scuffed boot prints on the back porch and cigarette butts near the side of the house. The realization that he had been lurking there for hours made me shudder. Though the police assured us he likely wouldn't return, the fear stayed. I spent the next few days watching the street through the curtains. Every time I heard a car drive by, my chest tightened, expecting it to be him. Thanksgiving had always been a holiday of joy and warmth, but that year it left me with a cold sense of vulnerability. Even now, I can't look at our back window without imagining those eyes staring in. This incident taught me a hard lesson about trust and safety. I no longer answer the door for strangers, no matter how harmless they seem. It's a small adjustment, but one that gives me peace of mind. And after that night, I'll take all the peace I can get. Thanksgiving has always been a big deal in my family. My parents' house, the one I grew up in, is the designated gathering spot. It's nothing fancy, just a modest two-story home with a big dining room that can barely fit everyone. Every year, relatives pile in from all over, bringing casseroles, pies, and enough food to feed a small army. This takes place back in 2017. The house was a whirlwind of delicious smells. Turkey, pie, and spiced cider. Everywhere I turned, someone was laughing, talking, or pouring another glass of wine. This was what family holidays were all about, the kind of chaos that reminded me why I loved Thanksgiving. But this time, there was someone new at the table. "Hey, everyone," my cousin Jeff said as he walked in, balancing a pie in one hand and patting the back of a guy I'd never seen before with the other. "This is Kyle. I invited him to join us." Kyle was tall and wiry, probably in his late 20s. His eyes darted around the room like he was sizing it up. His smile seemed genuine enough, though, and he carried a bottle of wine as a peace offering. "Nice to meet you," I said, shaking his hand. His grip was firm but quick, like he wanted to move on to the next person. The rest of the family greeted him warmly. Thanksgiving is about sharing, after all. My mom pulled him into the kitchen to show him where to put the wine, and soon he was blending in, laughing at jokes and piling his plate with food like he'd been coming to our dinners for years. At first, I didn't think much of Kyle. He seemed polite, even charming in a way. But as the night went on, his questions started to stand out. "So, how long have you lived here?" he asked my mom during dinner, looking at the staircase leading to the second floor. "Oh, decades," she said with a smile. "This old house has been through a lot with us." "Must have a lot of memories," Kyle said, his tone friendly, but his eyes stayed a little too long on the family photos lining the walls. Later, while I was refilling my drink, he came up to me in the kitchen. "You guys have a nice place," he said, looking toward the back door. "That yard must be great for summer barbecues." "It is," I replied. "We spend a lot of time out there." "Do you always keep the garage door open like that?" he asked casually. My expression shifted, confusion written all over it. "It's usually closed, but with everyone coming in and out today, I guess someone left it open." By dessert, it was getting harder to ignore how Kyle was paying a little too much attention to the house. He'd already asked about the security cameras out front and whether they worked. When he mentioned the jewelry box on the dresser in the guest room, something he could only have noticed by wandering upstairs, I felt my gut twist. "Jeff," I said quietly, pulling my cousin aside, "how do you know this guy?" Jeff looked sheepish. "We met online. He's been having a rough time lately, so I figured I'd invite him along. You know, show him some family warmth." "You just met him?" I asked, incredulous. "Yeah, but he's cool," Jeff said, brushing it off. I wasn't so sure. That night, after everyone had left, I did a quick walkthrough of the house, checking the doors and windows. Everything seemed fine, but I still felt uneasy. I chalked it up to overthinking and went to bed. The next morning, my mom woke me up with a knock on my door. "Someone's been in the house," she said, her voice trembling. I threw on some clothes and rushed downstairs. The back door was slightly ajar, and muddy footprints trailed across the kitchen floor. "What's missing?" I asked, already dreading the answer. "My jewelry box," my mom said, "and the tablet from the living room. I think your dad's watch is gone, too." I immediately thought of Kyle. Jeff came over as soon as we called him, looking just as stunned as the rest of us. "Kyle wouldn't do that," he said, shaking his head. He's a good guy. Are you kidding me? I snapped. He asked about the cameras, the garage, even the guest room upstairs. Who does that? Jeff didn't have an answer. We reported the break-in to the police, and they came to Dust for fingerprints and take statements. Do you know who might have done this? The officer asked. We have a strong suspicion, I said, explaining about Kyle. Jeff gave them the limited information he had, an email address, a phone number, and a vague idea of where Kyle might live. A few days later, we got a call from the police. They'd tracked Kyle down, but he denied everything. He claimed he'd left the house after dinner and didn't know anything about the stolen items. We've had other reports about him, the officer said. He's been linked to similar incidents, but nothing we can prove yet. Hearing that only made me feel worse. Kyle had used our Thanksgiving dinner as an opportunity to scout the house, just like he'd probably done to other families. Jeff was devastated. I can't believe I brought him here, he said. I thought I was helping someone. I'm grateful nothing worse happened and no one was hurt, but that incident changed how I see things. Thanksgiving is meant to bring people together, yet that year it showed us how important it is to protect what matters most. We learned a hard lesson about boundaries. Not everyone who smiles at you has good intentions, and trust should never come without caution. Kyle may have gotten away that time, but he didn't take what mattered most, our family's strength and determination to protect each other. My wife, Diane, came from a big, close-knit family and they knew how to throw a celebration. Her parents' home was a spacious, suburban spot with a big backyard and an old, weathered shed they used for storage. Every holiday felt like a slice of Americana, kids running around and adults chatting over wine. We'd finished dinner and the mood was warm and relaxed. I was sprawled on the couch with a cup of coffee, listening to Diane talk about work with her sister. Her dad was flipping through football games on TV and the kids were diving into dessert. It was the kind of evening that made you forget all the craziness of the world outside. But then, Diane's mom, who'd gone to grab something from the kitchen, called out in a panicked voice, "There's smoke in the backyard!" I shot up immediately. Thick, gray smoke was curling up into the night sky, illuminated by the glow of flames. The shed, just 20 feet from the house, was on fire. "Call 911," I shouted as I bolted for the back door. Diane's brother-in-law, Bennett, was right behind me. We grabbed the garden hose and fire extinguisher on the way out, knowing we had to keep the flames from spreading to the house. The fire was raging by the time we got close. The heat was intense, and the air reeked of burning wood and plastic. We started dousing the flames with the hose, but it was a losing battle. I directed the extinguisher toward the base of the fire, hoping to slow it down until the fire department arrived. As we worked, I noticed something odd. Near the edge of the shed, just outside the reach of the flames, was a gasoline can. It didn't belong there. My father-in-law was meticulous about his tools and supplies, and he'd never leave something like that out in the open. I nudged Bennett and pointed it out. "You think?" he started, but his voice trailed off as we both came to the same conclusion. Someone had started this fire. By the time the firefighters arrived, we'd managed to keep the flames from spreading, but the shed was a total loss. They extinguished the last of the fire while we huddled together on the patio, trying to understand the situation. The kids were inside with Diane and her mom, thankfully spared from the chaos outside. A firefighter approached us once things were under control. "We found evidence of an accelerant," he said. "Looks like gasoline was used to start the fire." My father-in-law's face darkened. "That shed's been locked for years. Why would anyone target it?" The firefighter shrugged. "Could be kids messing around or someone with a grudge. Hard to say." But it didn't feel random to me. Whoever did this wanted the fire to spread to destroy more than just an old shed. After the firefighters left, the police arrived to take statements. While we were explaining what had happened, one of the neighbors came over. Mr. Wilkes was an older guy, retired, with a front porch that gave him a perfect view of the neighborhood. He always seemed to know what was going on. "I saw someone hanging around earlier," he said. "A man, wearing a hoodie, He was walking up and down the street, looking at the houses. "What time was this?" the officer asked. "Right before dark," Wilkes replied. "Thought it was odd, but I didn't think much of it at the time." The description wasn't much to go on, but it added to the unease that was settling over all of us. Later that night, after the police left, we started cleaning up the mess. The shed was a charred husk, and the backyard was littered with ash and debris. Diane's dad whispered nervously under his breath, clearly unsettled. "Why target us?" he finally said. "We don't have enemies. We don't even know anyone who'd do something like this." I didn't have an answer. The gasoline can suggest intent, but the randomness of it all was unsettling. If someone was targeting us, why not go after the house? Why the shed? The next day, Diane and I stayed to help with the cleanup. By afternoon, we'd cleared most of the debris. The police hadn't found any solid leads, and the case was left open. Diane's parents were trying to move on, but the tension in the house was palpable. That evening, as we were packing up to leave, Mr. Wilkes stopped by again, his expression more serious than before. "I've been thinking," he said, lowering his voice. "This wasn't some accident or a random act. Whoever did this wanted to send a message. They weren't trying to burn the place down. They were trying to scare whoever was inside." It made too much sense. The fire wasn't a chaotic act of vandalism. It was targeted. Whoever had said it had no intention of remaining hidden. They wanted us to know someone had been there. This wasn't about property damage. It was about power, letting us know we weren't as safe as we thought. Over the next few weeks, Diane's parents installed security cameras and motion sensor lights around the property. Life slowly returned to normal, but we'll never forget that fire. To this day, we don't know who started the fire or why, but someone had a plan that night, and for reasons we'll never understand, they chose our family. If these Thanksgiving horrors left you gripping your seat, don't forget to like this video and subscribe for more spine-chilling stories. What would you do if you faced one of these terrifying situations? Share your thoughts in the comments. I'd love to hear your take. Pass this video along to friends and family to remind them that staying vigilant is key, even during the holidays. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next nightmare.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.